When President John F. Kennedy was inaugurated in 1961, Robert Frost was asked to recite a poem. He wrote a new poem for the occasion called Dedication. But when the time came for Frost to recite it, the glare of the snow kept him from reading the faint words on the page. So Frost recited another one of his poems from memory. The Gift outright spoke of how Americans came to possess this land, ending this way.
The deed of gift was many deeds of war to the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become, hath become, and for this occasion let me change that to what she will become.
Robert Frost improvising there at the JFK inauguration. Frost was the first. Since then, only three other poets have taken part in inaugurations: Maya Angelou, Miller Williams, and Elizabeth Alexander. Today, the Presidential Inauguration Committee announces this year's poet, Richard Blanco. A child of Cuban exiles, he's the first Hispanic and gay poet to be so honored. And he joined us to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Renee. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. This must be very exciting for you.
Oh, well, as you can imagine, I'm beside myself still, even though it's been a few weeks since I found out. I got a text message from my agent, who is usually a very calm and very well-together fellow, and he texted me and said, "You need to call me immediately." So luckily, I got in a traffic jam, and I was able to call him, and I heard the news, and of course, it took me 10 minutes still of just being stunned, just thinking about my parents and my grandparents and all the struggles that they've been through and how here I am, first-generation Cuban-American, and this great honor that has just come to me, and just feeling that sense of incredible gratitude and love.
Have you started writing the poem?
Well, I think I started writing it right there in my head on the way back home. Images started coming to me. What's interesting, as I think every inaugural poet has said, it's a very difficult assignment because it is an occasional poem. But writing about America is a topic that obsesses me in terms of cultural negotiation and my background as a Cuban American. And so it wasn't a completely unfamiliar topic, except it's always been from very deeply sort of personal, familial, lots of family lore and things like this. So it was a subject I felt somewhat comfortable, but the challenge of it was how to maintain sort of that sense of intimacy and that conversational tone in a poem that obviously has to sort of encompass a whole lot more than just my family, my experience.
You weren't born in America. Tell us about that journey.
Well, as my sort of little tongue-in-cheek bio says, I was made in Cuba, assembled in Spain, and imported to the United States, which means my mother left. She was 7 months pregnant with me when she left Cuba. And at that time in 1968, since there were no diplomatic relations, everybody had to go through what they call a third country. So we ended up in Spain. 45 days later, I was born. And a few weeks after that, we got on a plane and emigrated once more to New York City. So by the time I was about 2 or 3 months old, I had figuratively and literally been in three countries and could probably have claimed citizenship in any one of the three at that moment. And then eventually, when I was about 3 or 4, we settled down in Miami. And it's kind of, you know, as I look back in my life, as we all do, you kind of think, is this some kind of ironic or some kind of foreshadowing, of course, of what my work as a poet would be obsessed with? This whole idea of place and identity and what's home and what's not home, and which is in some ways such an American question that we've been asking since Whitman, trying to put that finger on America.
You do have a poem called America, which tackles this complex world that you grew up in. I'd like you to read a few lines from it, just to know you might give us a little explanation. It's from the point of view of a 7-year-old whose Cuban family always serves pork and yuca on Thanksgiving.
Right. And so this poem is sort of that angst and that plea by the 7-year-old child that we have Thanksgiving the way it's supposed to be. A week before Thanksgiving, I explained to my abuelita about the Indians and the Mayflower, how Lincoln set the slaves free. I explained to my parents about the Purple Mountain's majesty, One if by land, two if by sea, the cherry tree, the tea party, the amber waves of grain, the masses yearning to be free, liberty and justice for all, until finally they agreed this Thanksgiving we would have turkey as well as pork. So that was, and that's always what I've had to negotiate. I mean, to this day, my mom will make a turkey, but she always has a backup pork roast in the oven just in case for those that don't eat turkey.
4 years ago, the inauguration of the first black president was a moment that was filled with history. As someone who writes a lot about cultural identity in America, do you think that that milestone has brought about any changes in our society 4 years later?
The immediate answer is, I think, yes. Specific changes, maybe again, the way I look at the world as an artist, I don't know if it's something in the air that I definitely feel is different. I do remember that historic moment, and I remember thinking to myself, it was one of the proudest moments I ever had as far as being proud of America, in the sense of, like, I remember thinking to myself, you did it, America. My life in America, sort of feel a lot more open to possibility and a lot more sort of dreaming a lot more of who I can be and what I can do. And proof is in the pudding, you know, in the sense of being here an inaugural poet for this momentous occasion and the first Latino. I think that kind of mindset is contagious. I think it's something that many people feel in the air.
Thank you very much for joining us and congratulations.
Well, thank you, Renee. It's been a pleasure.
That's poet Richard Blanco. Today, the Presidential Inauguration Committee announces he will be reading a poem especially composed to usher in the president's second term.
Hopefully he'll be able to read the paper in the sun. The lineup for the inauguration was filled out a little further yesterday. Merle Evers Williams will deliver the invocation at the ceremonial swearing-in on January 21st. She's the widow of civil rights icon Medgar Evers, who was murdered outside their home in Mississippi 50 years ago. This is the first time that a woman will deliver the inaugural invocation, and it's also the first time that the prayer will not be delivered by a member of the clergy.
The benediction, however, will be delivered by a minister. Louis Giglio is the pastor at the Passion City Church in Atlanta. He's the founder of Passion Conferences, which holds annual spiritual gatherings aimed at young adults. Giglio is also a YouTube sensation, thanks to a sermon called How Great Is Our God. In the viral hit, he explores wonders of science and preaches that they are evidence of God's grace. This is NPR News.
The inner workings of government infuriate many Americans, but just now the inner workings of China's government are fascinating to many Chinese. Chinese customers are buying a lot of books about Machiavellian office politics. You could call this genre bureaucracy lit, if you like. And aside from the entertainment value, aspiring civil servants read these books as how-to guides for their careers. NPR's Louisa Lim has been studying this subject and compiled 5 secrets of success in China. Think of this as her audiobook.
Lesson 1. Cultivate your connections. A friend of mine is a lower-level civil servant. His boss had a passion for soccer, and so the entire office was soccer mad, playing games every week, watching overseas matches together, talking about the sport constantly. All of a sudden, the boss was transferred and a new one came in whose love was photography. Immediately, all the underlings were snapping photos and buying expensive camera equipment with office funds. Soccer was never mentioned again. Wang Xiaofang, the author of 13 bureaucracy-lit books, describes why cultivating official connections is so important.
Even the dogs and chickens of government officials go to heaven. Our officials, once they get power, they have power for life. This system of bureaucracy and power worship has become our cultural tradition. It's inside our bones.
Lesson 2. Learn to compromise, even if it makes you uncomfortable. The ultimate example is described in Wang's book, The Civil Servant's Notebook. The fictional old leader is a fan of the urine cure. To show loyalty, his unfortunate underling overcomes his own disgust and drinks his own urine for 5 years. He's rewarded with a promotion. The tightrope all aspiring civil servants must walk was described to me by Wang Yuewen, who started the craze for officialdom lit in 1999, with his novel, Ink Painting.
China is a country where the reality is so powerful that the individual feels insignificant. So anyone with a sense of morality must learn to compromise with reality and find ways of getting things done without violating their bottom line.
Lesson three, and this is key. Pick your camp well. Wang Xiaofeng's real-life story is an object lesson in the danger of ending up in the wrong camp. He spent almost 2 years as secretary to the deputy mayor of Shenyang, Ma Xiangdong. In 2001, Ma Xiangdong was found guilty of bribery and gambling away $3 million of public money. Ma was executed by lethal injection. Author Wang spent 3 years under investigation before being exonerated.
It was a spiritual purgatory. When I was going through that political storm, there were 3 years when I didn't have any work. I had to wait and help with the investigations. It was soul-destroying. My friends were gone. It was very painful.
This brings us to lesson four. Know when to step away. After that experience, Wang Xiaofeng left the civil service and became a writer. One character in his book describes the pressures on officials as being more than their flesh and blood bodies can withstand. His fellow author, Wang Yuewen, lost his job after his first book came out. He warns that little lies end up having huge consequences.
Telling lies, fakery, and falsification of official statistics has become a national disaster. If it's not stopped, it could bring about a national catastrophe.
Lesson 5, take the long view. Wang Xiaofeng hasn't published a book in 2 years. He has 3 finished novels ready to go, but no Chinese publisher dares touch them due to the political sensitivity surrounding the transition of power to a new generation of leaders. But he's still writing onto his 4th unpublished book, quietly hopeful that one day the political winds will change. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Let's just say right up front that the author Simon Garfield loves maps. Many hang on the walls of his home in London. His house, in fact, is filled with them, and so is his latest book, On the Map. He studies the history of maps and their effect on human progress. Mr. Garfield's map obsession began when he was a boy and discovered the famous map of the Tube, the London subway.
What's sort of extraordinary about it, it's sort of the most reproduced, geographically inaccurate map that you can find. So it looks as though every stop on the Tube is about a mile apart. But in fact, they vary from, you know, a few hundred yards to 4 or 5 miles. And so it creates a very kind of neat picture of London. If you're a tourist, you arrive for the first time, you think, oh, this is going to be so easy. It's only actually when you get out of the underground you realize it's not so easy. But I mean, when I looked at the map for the first time, the places at the end of the line, at the end of the Metropolitan line or the Piccadilly line, seemed to me the most exotic places you could ever go in the world. They were like sort of my Antarctica, I suppose, in a way. And so really ever since then I've been fascinated by maps.
There is something, as you point out in the book, about a map that makes you want to travel, makes you want to go to whatever is pictured there.
I think the great appeal to me is not only the fact that you can plan and you can dream and you're almost there by looking at the maps, you're sort of almost there. But the other great appeal really is how it sort of relates our history, you know, how it tells our kind of our human tales.
And that brings us to the other point, because you mentioned inaccuracies, deliberate inaccuracies in the London Underground map. In going through your history of maps here, I noticed you frequently use the word distortion. The maps are distorted, sometimes unintentionally, but sometimes quite intentionally, because whoever's drawing the map has a purpose in mind.
Exactly. I mean, maps, as you say, they are political and carry great kind of untruths. The biggest distortion of all, I suppose, is, you know, the famous sort of Mercator map from the 16th century, which we still use now. You know, that is the traditional map that you have on your classroom wall.
Let's describe that to make sure that people can picture it. This is the map where the latitudinal lines, instead of coming together like they would at the top of the Earth, it's flat, And so they are parallel, and so everything becomes huge near the North and South Poles. Like Greenland is immense. Canada is ridiculously large.
Exactly right. So Greenland is shown at the, you know, as the size of Africa, with Africa is 10 times or more larger than Greenland. You know, the other point is that it's a bit like the famous phrase that history is written by the winners, by the victors. And it's the same with map makers. If you have the power to commission a map or make your own map, you're going to make it reflect your world and reflect your views. So that could be, you know, if you had a strong Christian worldview, you would put Jerusalem at the middle of the map. In ancient Greece, you would go right back and it would be Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, off Greece, which is now what you would regard mostly as a kind of holiday island. Mm-hmm. And it absolutely relies on tourism and not much else. But, you know, in ancient Greece, it was the center of world maps because it was such a, you know, a big economic center and trading port. It tells you a lot about kind of world history, how we saw ourselves. That's the wonderful thing, really, about old maps is, obviously you realize how the world has changed, but you realize, you know, how we place ourselves upon it when the map was drawn.
So these maps aren't just describing what's there. They're describing a point of view about what is there. Is there a map in your study of the history of maps that you would regard as actually evil?
I suppose I have a kind of interesting thought on that, really, is that I quite like inaccuracies. I quite like things that aren't quite right, really. I mean, you don't want to be a sailor on a boat trying to get to a particular place and have a map that's wrong. But you also kind of think, well, actually, this is how we make a lot of our discoveries, you know. You could argue that one of the principal maps, without doubt, that Columbus used was drawn up hundreds of years before the Great Library of Alexandria by Claudius Ptolemy. And although he modelled his maps very much on scientific principles, using information from navigators and from other previous scholars, he just got things wrong as well. So I don't think you'd regard him as kind of evil, because I think he was acting on sort of best intentions. But he did just kind of make things up. And that's sort of one other factor of the kind of history of maps is sort of how much we abhor a blank space on a map. You know, we kind of hate that because it suggests ignorance. And it suggests that we're not in control somehow. So, you know, he got the whole kind of latitude wrong of where Asia was on the maps, which is why Columbus found America and didn't get to his riches in Japan and the Indies.
Oh, because he thought it was just a short hop across to Japan.
Exactly. He thought that the journey would be a third of the one that he actually had to do to get to Japan, which is why he hit South America instead.
Okay, so now we're in an age of satellite mapping, of GPS. Are we better off?
Well, I fall into two camps here. I use, you know, my maps on my phone, and it's far easier to put my GPS on than to have to consult a map. But gosh, I mean, do we lose a lot? We lose, you know, the beauty of maps. We lose the romance of maps. We lose that terrible feeling that we will never be able to fold up a map again. Mm. And I think the other thing, you know, we lose is a real sense of how big the world is. Because now we look at our maps and there's a real sense of, okay, get me to where I want to go. You know, so you get the feeling actually it's all about me.
Oh, because if I look at a GPS map, there's a dot where I am, and that's the middle of everything, no matter what else happens.
Exactly. It's a terribly sort of egocentric way of looking at the world. So I think we're getting, I think the view of where we are in the world and the history of the world is changing. And I think in a way it's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, impacts of the digital and technological revolution is how we see ourselves in the world. And in a way, that was the idea of the book, to kind of look back and tell these great tales and to think about what we might be losing in the process of accepting all these extremely good and generally very accurate maps of the world on our phones.
Simon Garfield is the author of On the Map. Thanks very much.
I enjoyed it.
We're glad that we're on your map, your mental map anyway, thanks to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition. We're also on your social media map. If you'd like, you can find us on Facebook. We are also on Twitter. Got many handles there, including at Morning Edition, at NPR Green, and at NPR Inskeep.
If anyone knew what it took to cover a presidential campaign, it was Richard Ben Kramer. His book about the 1988 election, titled What It Takes, was the defining campaign treatment of the last half century. Prior to that, Kramer was a Pulitzer-winning foreign correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Kramer died Monday of complications from lung cancer. He was 62. NPR's David Folkenflik has this remembrance.
The conceit of What It Takes was deceivingly simple. Kramer, a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun and the Philadelphia Inquirer, would immerse himself in the campaigns of six candidates running for the nation's highest office and figure out the discipline and confidence that enabled them to run.
Alas, in the nature of the process, five out of six of them are doomed to fail. So it was really the internal monologue that I was trying to cover, whereby the person comes to the point where he thinks he ought to be president, then thinks he will be president, and finally has to come off of that certainty.
Here, Kramer was speaking in June 1992 to John Hockenberry on NPR. When Hockenberry suggested that he seemed to fall for each of the candidates, Kramer was unapologetic.
I spent 6 years on this book. So at various times in it, you are viscerally connected to every one of these men. I think that stepping back from it now, as for the first time in years I can, I think that all of these men deserve a book on their own. But it may be that Bob Dole deserves a Russian novel.
Over 1,000 pages, What It Takes offered a sympathetic but unflinching sense of the aspirations, hopes, motivations, failings, and even strengths of the various figures. Vice President Joe Biden, one of the book's unsuccessful candidates, released a statement today that was rare for a Washington politician in that it displayed self-reflection. He wrote, quote, "It is a powerful thing to read a book someone has written about you and to find both the observations and criticisms so sharp and insightful that you learn something new and meaningful about yourself."
You know, there were times when you just knew that he was having fun.
Former Baltimore Sun reporter and author Robert Timberg competed against Kramer at Baltimore City Hall.
He could take something that I wouldn't even think about writing about and write about it, and it was still not worth writing about except the way Richard wrote about it. You couldn't not read it. I mean, it was just so colorful and so funny.
When Kramer profiled Baltimore's William Donald Schaefer for Esquire, he dubbed Schaefer Mayor Annoyed, as in the start of every newspaper headline. Mayor Annoyed about potholes, Mayor Annoyed about highway delays, Mayor Annoyed about whatever caught his eye that day. Stu Seidel and Kramer met as undergraduates at Johns Hopkins University and became lifelong friends. Seidel, now NPR's managing editor for Standards and Practices, said Kramer routinely kept him waiting for ball games and dinners, but for a reason.
If he was talking to someone, he was absorbed in that conversation. He caused the people that he was talking to be absorbed in talking with him, and they told him stories. They took him places in their own minds and in their own hearts and in their own experience that other reporters just didn't manage.
Kramer never became a creature of Washington, writing books about baseball greats Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams, yet he made his mark in D.C. Earlier today at the White House press room, a place in which, as far as we can tell, Kramer never posed a question, presidential spokesman Jay Carney recalled coming to Washington as a young reporter for Time magazine.
A colleague of mine handed me that book as I began to cover politics, and it was the best read imaginable. And if there's anyone in this room who has not read What It Takes, run out and buy it now.
A rare literary endorsement from behind the White House lectern. Kramer is survived by his wife, Joan, and his daughter, Ruby. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A new memoir explores one woman's life through her friendships with other women. It's called She Matters, A Life in Friendships by Susanna Sonnenberg. And Meg Wolitzer has our review.
You know how sometimes in life you make a friend and at first it's really intense? You talk with your heads close together. You try to tell her everything about yourself over tea and white wine. And you think that all that sharing will make you close forever. But it doesn't really work that way. Friendships change a lot. And I think books can be like that, too. They can shift, and then you have all these complicated feelings when you have to adjust your expectations. I feel this way about Susanna Sonnenberg's memoir, She Matters, A Life in Friendships. Her descriptions totally drew me in, like this friend from summer camp. She stood next to me and we held in our stomachs when Greg LaRosa ambled by and said hi. She explained marshmallow spread as we sat down with trays of fluffernutter sandwiches. Sonnenberg tells us, she made me a peach pit ring, and I made her a peach pit ring. On my last day, we said, how can I live without you? It's like Judy Blume perfection. When Sonnenberg gets older, she realizes some of her friends can live without her. There are some really bad breakups in this book. Once her college roommate from 25 years ago sends her a letter. What she remembered of our acquaintance was that she hated me, Sonnenberg writes. Another time, she has a relaxed lunch with a friend and then gets this email that's so blunt it's like a wartime telegram. I can't be friends with you anymore, it says. I felt sad for her. She has this really amazing lack of vanity that I loved, even if I was a little taken aback by her intensity. She actually made me wonder about my own friendships. If I wrote them all down like this, would they look this fraught? At first, I thought the memoir was basically a beautifully written, emotional, and nostalgic look at the way women become friends. In the end, it's also really a book about boundary issues. But in between is where all the meat is. It's the part that makes you question what a friend really is. You're not related to them, and you're not married to them. So what exactly do you owe each other? What are the rules? Susanna Sonnenberg doesn't answer that. But she has written something that manages to interest, to exhaust, to impress, and yes, to matter.
Susanna Sonnenberg's new memoir is She Matters, A Life in Friendships. Our reviewer is Meg Wolitzer. Her most recent novel is The Uncoupling. For more news about books, you can visit our NPR Books page on Facebook.